We turn once again this morning to the Epistle of Paul to the Romans, and we are still dealing with the Christian life that Paul is expounding and explaining and exhorting us to in chapter 12 onwards. It's important for us to remember that the Christian faith is never meant simply to be a theoretical exercise. It always must lead to practice. Faith and faithfulness go together in the Bible. And indeed, in the Old Testament, the idea of faith has more to do with the practice of faithfulness than it has to do with the theoretical analysis of simply believing. And that is one of the things that we learn, especially out of Hebrews chapter 11, where we have that great passage analyzing the faith of the Old Testament saints. And the writer is concerned not so much to analyze their faith in the terms of what it was, but in terms rather of what it did. And that is why he gives us a whole list of Old Testament characters by faith, so-and-so was enabled to do something. And it's precisely the same when we come into New Testament times. There is no change. Faith is practical. Faith works by love. Faith without works is dead. And faith ultimately is vindicated by faithfulness. James reminds us that Abraham was justified by works. In James chapter 2, this does not contradict what Paul says when he tells in Romans chapter 4 that Abram was justified by faith. It simply means that Abram's faith by which he was justified was a real faith. It was vindicated. It was evidenced. His faith was vindicated by the works of obedience that he, in fact, displayed. And so this is the consistent teaching of the Bible. And this is what Paul is telling us in Romans chapter 12 onwards. He has been dealing in this great epistle with the theme of righteousness lacking in man, righteousness provided by God. And now he is dealing with righteousness worked out in the lives of those who are justified by faith. We have been looking at chapter 12 for the past number of weeks, analyzing the way that Paul gives us a closely analyzed view of the Christian life. And as I think I've mentioned more than once, and it's worth repeating it, if something is worth saying once, it's worth saying more than once. And that is that chapter 12 is the Christian life in a nutshell, according to the Bible. Just as Hebrews chapter 11 is faith in action, so Christian life is described for us in Romans chapter 12. And if we would want to know what it means to be a Christian, we would do well to analyze, remember, and indeed memorize Romans chapter 12. We've been looking at this chapter now for a number of weeks, and we've seen how the Christian life begins with a new understanding, a new relationship to God, living sacrifices, not being conformed to this world, but being transformed by the renewing of our mind. But the Christian life is lived out in the nitty-gritty of this life. We live in the world, not off it, but nonetheless in it. And our Christian life is lived out, as Paul is making very clear in these verses in chapter 12, and indeed right through to the end of the epistle. The Christian life is lived out in terms of relationships. Relationships to God, relationships to God's people. And from verse 14 of chapter 12, especially relationships in terms of a hostile environment in the world. How are we to relate to God? Well, Paul tells us that in the opening verses. He gives us some examples of teaching, leadership, gifts. Then from verse 9, he speaks of those gifts that are peculiarly required for life within the fellowship, within the body of Christ. And from verse 14, how we are to relate to the world. And it's evident from what Paul is saying that the world is not over-friendly to Christians. It's difficult to live peaceably with everybody. And there are times when we're going to be persecuted and such like things. And Paul is telling us how we're to respond to these circumstances that inevitably are going to come. And the last time that we were in Romans chapter 12, we were looking at the verses 19 to 21, where Paul is forbidding private vengeance. And he is saying that we overcome evil not simply by not doing evil, we overcome evil by doing good. There is such a thing as the do-nothing Christianity. It simply does no evil, does no harm to its neighbor, but neither does it do much good. And we don't overcome evil by doing no evil. We overcome evil only by doing good. Now, when we come to Romans chapter 13, in the first seven verses, which we're going to be looking at this morning, and indeed we're going to be spending a week or two looking at these verses, it's important for us to keep in mind that Paul is not changing the subject. Paul is simply going on to deal with the Christian in relationship to the world in which he lives. And in the verses 14 to 18, he's been speaking of those private relationships that we have with other people. From verse 19 to 21, he's been speaking of a specific kind of circumstance where we might be tempted to vengeance, and we must not allow ourselves to give way to that temptation for private vengeance. And then when Paul goes on to speak of the higher authorities, the powers that be, in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 to 7, he is not speaking of something essentially different to what he's been talking about in the previous verses. He is simply speaking of how is the Christian to live in terms of civil government. What is our response to be to what Paul calls the higher authorities, what our translation calls the higher powers. And this is what these verses, Romans 13, 1 to 7, is all about. Let's just read these verses again to remind ourselves of them, because they are most important. They are often misunderstood and misapplied. And if Christian people, as well as the world at large, but if Christian people had paid more attention to what Paul is actually saying, there would have been less religious wars for a start. There would have been less schismatic troubles in the church. There would have been less conflict between church and state. And a great many books which have been written on the relationship of church and state would need not have been written, because everybody would have understood what the Christian position was on these things if we had listened more carefully to what Paul is actually saying in Romans 13, 1-7. He says this: let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power or no authority but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resists the power, resists the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves condemnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Will you then not be afraid of the authority of the magistrate, the civil magistrate? Do that which is good, and you shall have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if you do that which is evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a servant of God, a revenger, an avenger, to exercise wrath upon him that does evil. Wherefore you must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake, for this cause you pay tribute also. For they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. One of the commentators makes the point that in these words Paul is giving perhaps the best definition of political theory that the world has ever known. But the commentator goes on to point out that it is probably true that no political power has ever paid any attention to the teaching of St. Paul. And that probably is true. The Apostle Paul here is speaking not as a pragmatist. There are those who say, well, it's all very well in a time of peace, and at the time in Rome, the Christian church was living in peace. But if a few years later Paul had been writing, there are those who say he would have written rather differently. because within a period of 10 years from writing this epistle, we know that the Roman persecution against the Christians began, and it ultimately ended in the martyrdom of Paul and the Apostle Peter also, we believe, in the year 67 AD under Nero. We'll comment on that later on. But Paul is not speaking here pragmatically. He is speaking theologically. He is speaking as an apostle. He is writing as God's penman. This is God's view of civil government, and this is God's view of how Christians and everybody else is to respond. Now, our purpose in looking at these verses and spending a week or two in them is not to go into political theories. It's not my business to tell you how to vote or what your political views should be. I'm not really all that interested in what your views are on these things. That's your private affair. And I have never at election times, I know of some ministers in pulpits who at election time they tell their congregations how to vote. Well, in my time here now, we've had quite a number of elections, and I don't remember ever suggesting to you remotely how you should vote. That's entirely up to you. That's not our business as preachers of the gospel. Our task is to try to explain the word of God and apply it to those who care to listen to what we have to say. Now, these verses, 1 to 7 in Romans chapter 13, are therefore Paul's exhortation to Christian believers to live in relationship to the civil government. Just as we have seen, he is exhorting us to live in relationship to God, to one another, to individuals who persecute us and so on. How then are we to regard and respond to the powers that be, the national governments or the local governments? Paul is not differentiating between national and local government. He just speaks of the higher authorities. Everybody in authority. And some of the commentators make the view, Hodge, for example, takes the view that the principles here apply to all authority. They apply to school teachers. They apply to those over us in industry. They apply to fathers and mothers in the home. And that's an extension of what Paul is saying, but it may well be a legitimate extension. You see, the problem is that the verses that we have before us are very simple. They're obvious. One is only to read them. There's no big words used here. The language is pretty straightforward. Indeed, it is rather repetitive. Paul, in order to drive home, makes the same point over again. But nonetheless, there are difficulties, because it's not simply a matter of what does Paul say. It's a matter of what does Paul mean. And this is where the difficulties lie. And it's all very well for us to say, well, we just believe the Bible. Well, that's good. That's the best thing we can possibly do. But we believe the Bible according to our understanding of what the Bible actually means. And two people can read the Bible, the same Bible, and come to different conclusions as to what it means. And this passage here is probably one of those passages that Peter has in mind when he tells us in 2 Peter chapter 3 there are some things in Paul's epistles that are hard to be understood. They're not hard to be understood in terms of the language or in terms of the general trend as to what they mean, but they are hard to be understood in the practicalities of them, because Paul in certain places in this passage cannot mean what on the face of it he seems to mean. And that's where the difficulty lies, and this is where we will all have to come with our varied understanding. We all have different brains. We're all different. We've all had different experiences in life. And so we come to the scriptures with all our views and our particular experiences governing our understanding of what the Bible is actually saying. So when we look at these verses, we're going to have to look at them on the one hand, taking them simply as they stand, but trying to apply them and understand them in the light of what the Bible says in other places, because we've got to take a conjunct view of Scripture. And there is a principle of interpretation of the Bible, and that is that you always interpret less clear passages in the light of clearer passages. You never do the reverse. You never take an obscure passage of the Bible and make it as a focal point of any doctrine. You don't do that. That's bad exegesis and bad interpretation. You always understand the major doctrines of truth in terms of clear teaching, and any rather difficult passages must be understood in the light of those clearer passages of the Bible. So the way we're going to look at this is we're going to speak generally about these verses this morning. Then we're going to look at what Paul tells us about the responsibilities of government, and then we're going to look on another occasion at our responsibility to government, because all of that's included here. And as I say, I'm not settling into some political theorizing. We're trying to expound the scriptures. So what is this passage all about? Well, notice how Paul begins to deal with the civil magistrate by giving to us what seems to be an absolutely blank and unqualified exhortation to obedience. Let every soul, he says, be subject unto the higher powers. And there immediately we have a problem. Because what does Paul mean by the higher powers? There are those who say that Paul is speaking of ideal government, and that what Paul is saying here is that we are to understand governments as governments ought to be, the ideal government. We all, I suppose, have our ideas of what an ideal government ought to be. I know that I've got my view, and I suppose that you've got a view. It may be similar to mine, it may be quite different. But we all have our ideas as to how we would like governments to be and governments to function. And there are those who say that Paul here is, in fact, laying out before us the ideals of government, that he is the minister of God, that he is a terror to wicked doers and a rewarder of those that do good and so on. But Paul is not speaking about ideal governments. Paul is speaking about governments as they actually are. He is speaking about every government. He is speaking about any government that you care to mention. He simply is speaking of government in the broadest and the most undefined terms. And what Paul is saying, in effect, is that every single government, without exception, is the servant of God and is ordained by God. And these governments may well differ, as we're going to see. So the first thing is, Paul is not speaking in some ideal context. He's speaking in the terrible realities of governments in the world as they actually are at any particular time that you care to mention, or any particular place. If Paul has an ideal government in view, then most of our life as Christians, we are not obliged to obey what Paul is saying, because we do not live under that kind of government. We live under the government as it is, and governments change. And what Paul is saying is that all Christians, indeed all people, let every soul, he says. He's not speaking simply about Christians. He is speaking particularly to Christians, because he's saying that Christians are to be the model citizens of any society in which we find ourselves. But nonetheless, he is laying an obligation on every soul to be obedient and respectful and submissive to whatever the government is that happens to be in power. And that, in fact, is what Paul is saying. And that is where the difficulty lies in understanding how are we actually to become a subject to these higher powers. So the Apostle Paul is not speaking in some kind of ideal, theoretical way. He's dealing with the Christian life as it is in this world in terms of relationships. The difficulty of living the Christian life has already been spoken by the apostle. It's difficult not to seek vengeance. It's very difficult always to recompense no man evil for evil. It is a difficult thing to provide things honest always in the sight of all men. It is difficult, as Paul understands in verse 18 of chapter 12, to live at peace with all men. That is something that really takes a great deal of effort, and it's not something that comes easily. And it's the same in response to civil government. It is not easy to respect certain governments, let alone be subject unto them. But nonetheless, that is the Christian position. That is what God requires of us as citizens of any society. We are to be subject unto the powers that be. And this applies to all Christians without exception. Now you see, immediately this raises the issue, because there have been Christian groups down through history who have said, we will not submit to government. We will not submit to government in terms of serving in the armed forces. We will not submit to government. In terms of taking part in elections, we will not submit to government. In terms of joining any political party, we will not submit to government in terms that the state has absolutely no say whatsoever in church affairs. And church and state must be totally separate. They belong to two separate realms. And Christians have differed down through the years over a whole host of issues concerning this basic fundamental issue of how are we and how far are we to be subject unto the civil power. Now this raises the question, we are to be subject, and this means respectful, this means obedient, and Paul tells us why it is that we are to be subject to the civil government. First of all, he tells us because the civil government is ordained of God. And we'll come back to that shortly. And what Paul is saying is we are to be submissive to the civil government because not to be so is actually to be disobedient to God. It is to resist, as he says in verse 2, whosoever resisteth the power resists the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves condemnation. Not only condemnation from the civil government because he doesn't bear the sword in vain, but also condemnation by God. God condemns the man who is guilty of civil disobedience when he ought not to be guilty of civil disobedience. And then we are to be submissive to government. We're giving a general outline this morning. We'll come back to look at some of these things more closely. We are also to be submissive because he is not a ruler to, he is a ruler, the rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. If we would not be afraid of having the police coming knocking at our door, then Paul says, don't break the law. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good. And the civil power will leave you alone to get about your business. At least that is in general terms. He is the minister of God to thee for good. We'll see what that means on another occasion. What is the minister? What is the government actually meant to be in relation to God and in relation to the people? But if thou do that which is evil, then you certainly have cause to be afraid, because he bears not the sword in vain. He is the minister of God, Paul says, a revenger. You see, what the Christian is forbidden to do privately, avenge not yourselves, leave it to the Lord, the civil magistrate is obliged to do. He is obliged to make a differentiation between those who do right and those who do wrong, and to punish the evildoer, to be an avenger of wickedness, and to stand up for the victim of crime, and on the other hand, to be a vindicator of those who do what is good. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. And part of our submission to the civil magistrate is that we obey him not only because he bears not the sword in vain, and we do not wish to experience his wrath, but also for conscience' sake, Paul says. If you and I would have a good conscience before God and men, we must therefore be model citizens of obedience. This is what Paul is saying, you see. This is the surface meaning of what he says. And then he speaks of submission in terms of paying our taxes. There are those who pride themselves that they don't pay taxes. Well, we had better be very careful, because the Bible says we are to pay our taxes. And Paul gives two different kinds of taxes here. He says you must needs be for this cause you pay tribute, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their Jews tribute to whom tribute, custom to whom custom. People who simply live off the state as some kind of parasites. There are those who can't work. There are those who are ill, and any society really must take care of its own. But there are some who could pay their taxes, and they don't. They don't work. They don't pay their taxes. They are violating basic principles of what Paul is saying here in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 to 7. Render therefore to all their Jews tribute to whom tribute, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And all of this Paul is laying upon us as Christian believers. This is our duty to God. It's not some extra thing that we do in addition to living the Christian life. Part of being a Christian is that we are good citizens, that we cause no trouble, that we commit no crimes, that we respect the laws of the land. We may not particularly like some of the laws of the land, but that's not the point. That is not the issue whatsoever. We submit to the laws of the land up to a certain point, as we're going to see. And so the Apostle Paul here is making it very clear what it means to be a Christian living in a society. For the sake of a clean conscience towards God and towards men, we submit to the higher powers. Now here Paul is emphasizing something fundamental. And this is why the commentator who says that Paul is writing here the greatest tract on political economy that the world probably is ever going to know, but probably no political theorist or political party or any pragmatic political figure it would take his politics from St. Paul, is because Paul introduces God. He says the powers that be are ordained of God. And this raises the question, what kind of government does God ordain? What kind of government does God approve of? Does God approve of all governments equally? The answer to that is no. Does God, as it were, does he condemn all governments equally? The answer again is no. And so the issue is, where in the Bible do we find any form of government that actually has the imprimatur of God? And the fact of the matter is, we don't find any. There is no particular form of government of which the Bible stipulates this is the way that nations must be governed. And I'm emphasizing that because on this point, Christian people are quite dogmatic very often, and they differ quite markedly. And when you read the history of Christian thinkers, even going back to the apologists and those that were particularly interested in the reformers and the Puritans, you find that they differed quite markedly as to what form of government actually was most pleasing to God. And the fact of the matter is, there doesn't seem to be any form of government that is particularly pleasing to God. There are some governments which are less God-honoring than others, but there is nowhere in the Bible where, for example, you will find God says this is the way that nations ought to be ruled. Now, there are those who perhaps are saying, but hang on a minute, what about the theocracy of Israel? Well, there was a time in the history of Israel when it was a theocratic nation, and they were governed largely by the priests and the prophets of God. But that was never intended for Gentile nations. There's no place in the whole of the Bible that says that the nations of the world are to be governed by some priestly caste or some prophetic order. That was for Israel. And as we know from our confession, that God gave to Israel certain diverse laws and statutes which did not belong to any other nation, which were for that time. You see, at the time of the Old Testament people of Israel, the nation and the church were one, and they were not differentiated. The rules of God in the nation of Israel were not only religious rules, they were criminal rules, they were civil rules. The books of Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, these are the codes for the nation of Israel, in terms of its religious code, its civil code, how to behave in marriage and bringing up of children, but also its criminal code. It was all put together, and it was all under that theocratic system, because there was no distinction made between Israel as a nation and Israel as the covenant people of God. But these rules that belonged to Israel were never intended by God to be implemented as part of his purpose for all the world in all the nations of the earth. And there are those who say, well, but what about monarchy? Monarchy is the way that God approves of a government. No, it's not. God never intended, in a sense, his people to be ruled by kings. The first king in Israel wasn't God's choice, it was the people's choice. And we know from the books of Samuel how when the people were clamoring for a king, that was not a movement that was initiated by the Lord. It was a movement, it was a request that the Lord conceded to, because the people wanted to be like everybody else. All the nations round about had kings ruling over them, and they wanted to be just like every other nation. And you may remember what God said to Samuel when they were determined to have a king. He said, "They have not refused you from being ruler over them. They have refused me." And when they're wanting a human king to reign over them, they are simply rejecting my kingly rule over them. So we'll give them a king. And then when you look at the monarchy in Israel, how long do you think it lasted? Most of Israel's history in the Old Testament was not under monarchy. Monarchy lasted for less than 500 years in Israel. It lasted for something like 463 years, and then it finished. And the gap between the Old Testament and the New Testament, for example, is longer. That's a longer gap than the entirety of the monarchy in Israel. Now, I'm emphasizing that because probably it is the case that most people in this congregation and congregations of a Reformed Protestant persuasion are probably monarchist in their thinking and in their politics, a kind of monarchist republicanism. But most people probably would be in favor of keeping the monarchy as opposed to establishing a republican form of government in Australia. Now, I don't mind if Australia becomes a republic. I'm happy for Australia to be a monarchist government if, in fact, that is what we have. When you think of Queen Elizabeth II as being the supreme executive of the Commonwealth, then I would far rather have her in that supreme position than other people I can think about, because the supreme position must be occupied always by somebody. And if you've got a benign monarch, then that's as good as you can probably get in this present world. But we must never imagine that there is something inherently of a divine right in monarchy. The Bible does not teach that. And Paul is not speaking when he's writing to the church at Rome to be subject to the higher powers. He is not speaking concerning a monarchy. He is writing to a people, the church at Rome, who are under a heathen, pagan, republican kind of government. And the head of that government, when the Apostle Paul was writing, was Nero. And within 10 years of Paul writing this great epistle to the Romans, there was going to be the first official persecution by Rome against the Christians. It broke out about 7 or 8 years after Paul wrote this epistle. And 10 years after writing this epistle, Paul was executed by the Roman authority under Nero. And it is that government that Paul is saying to these Roman Christians, "You submit to the powers that be." This is Nero on the throne. One of the grandest, cruelest men that you would ever find. Self-aggrandizement, a megalomaniac. He finally committed suicide, as we know, because he knew that everything was up with him. But this is the government that these Christians were under. This is the government that they were to live under. And it is quite wrong for Christian believers to say that there is a republican view. That is what the Bible teaches. There's a monarchist view. That is what the Bible teaches. The Bible doesn't teach any particular form of government. As Charles Hodge points out in his commentary, he says, "Government is from God. The forms of government come from men. And God sanctions whatever form of government men will have for a time. Some forms of government happen to last longer than others. Tyrannical forms of government, incidentally, tend not to last because the people just frankly don't put up with them." But tyranny is, in fact, a form of government which, while it lasts, is to be submitted to and recognized as the official government of the day. The Roman government that Paul was asking these Christians to submit to was basically built on brute force. It was built on military conquest. Paul, as a Jew, is a member of a race that was forcibly oppressed by this very regime. And yet Paul is recognizing that is God's government for his people in his time, in his day. And that's the way it is. There are different forms of government, and they're all different kinds. There are, well, there's monarchy, there's democracy, that's ruled by the people. There's what a form of government called plutocracy. There have been, and in fact there are still in this world even today, certain countries where you have to have a certain income before you're included in the ruling classes. That's called plutarchy. And then there's oligarchy, where it is only limited to just a few. You've got to be born into the right circles, otherwise you'll never become part of the ruling family or the ruling class. Do you know that at the height of the British Empire, 400 families ruled the world? 400 families, roughly. The empire over which Queen Victoria said, the sun never sets on my empire. And 400 families basically ruled that empire. That was a kind of aristocracy. It was a kind of oligarchy. Some of them weren't very rich, but they were born, as they say, with blue blood. You could be as poor as a church mouse, but if you belonged to the right family, you were in. You were a member of the club. You became a member of the regiment. You became a member of the inner circle. And it was a kind of oligarchy. It masqueraded as monarchy, but it really, in effect, was just a rule by a few people. We happen to be living in Australia at a time when this country is under a form of government which is generally described as a liberal democratic society. But it may not last. It may not last. The monarchy may go. It may well take a form of republicanism. I think it probably will in the end. But it may well develop into a different form. What are Christians in the future to do when they find that they're no longer living under the good old days of Queen Elizabeth and her heirs? Well, they're to do what Paul tells them to do in Romans chapter 13. They're to submit to whatever form of government it is. It may be a tyranny. It may be a heathen government. It may be an Islamic government for all we know. But the Christian believers in this land will submit to what Paul is saying here. Paul was not speaking to Christians who were under a godly government, who sympathized with the Christian gospel. He is speaking to Christians having to live in a society and under the governmental authority of a regime which has no sympathy whatsoever with the Christian gospel. And yet the powers that be are ordained of God. And when you read the great turbulences of the Reformation and the Puritan era, you find this coming out very, very clearly. John Calvin had a different view than Martin Luther. And the Reformation under Martin Luther took a different form than it took under John Calvin, for the simple reason that they had different views of government. Martin Luther was quite prepared to allow dukes and archdukes and electors and different kinds of ranks of rulers in those days, because there were over 300 different groups in Germany when Martin Luther was establishing his Protestant revolution. And Martin Luther was quite aware of the fact that he depended upon the princes and the electors and the dukes and the archdukes and so on. And so he was quite prepared to allow that these people would rule and that they would have a large say in what the religion of the people was going to be. John Calvin was an aristocratic kind of person, and in his early writings John Calvin leaned to a kind of aristocratic form of government. But as he grew older and wiser, he began to recognize that governments themselves could be the arch criminals, and he began to be more and more sympathetic to a kind of republicanism. And in his mature years, Calvin was inclining more and more not to rule by the aristocrats but rule by the people. You see, he changed his view. And if you and I were in the time of the Puritans in Scotland and in England, at the time of the Reformation and the time of the great upheavals of these wars, we would be divided. Most of the Puritans, as we know from the English Civil War, were in fact not monarchists at all. They were actually parliamentarians. And for about 9 years or so under Cromwell, England became a kind of a republic. And it had the backing of most of the Puritan clergy in London and other these south counties. Scotland was always more royalist, and they were in favor of the return of the king. but they weren't by any means united, but they knew the limitations and the dangers of kingship. I'm sure we are all familiar, those of you who know your Scottish history and these great Reformation times and covenanting times, that you will know of that great interview, that private interview between Andrew Melville and King James VI of Scotland. The place was Falkland Palace, the year was 1596, and Andrew Melville, in that interview with the young king, because King James was a Stuart, you see, they believed in the divine right. No kings, no bishop, no kings, no kirk, as far as James VI was concerned. And you remember how Andrew Melville went in and spoke to him. He says, I've told you before, he says, and I'll tell you again, there are two kingdoms in Scotland. There is one which is the kirk, and it's ruled by King Jesus, and in that kingdom James has no place of rule or head or kingship. He is a member of it. There is another kingdom in Scotland over which King James is the king, and to which we will willingly give our submission and reverence and obedience. You see, there are two kingdoms, and kingdoms in conflict always clash. And the issue is that when the Christian believer, in whatever society he finds himself, when he finds that he is going to live as a Christian, he finds that sooner rather than later there is going to be a clash. And there is going to come a time when he may have to make up a choice. To which kingdom ultimately does the Christian believer belong? We belong ultimately and primarily to the kingdom of God. And when Paul is giving these exhortations in Romans chapter 13, 1-7, he is speaking of Christians as citizens of heaven primarily. We obey for conscience sake. We submit to the civil magistrate because the civil magistrate is God's minister for the commonwealth at that time. And so ultimately in submitting to the civil magistrate, we are ultimately submitting to God. We are obeying God's ordinance. But what happens if the civil magistrate goes too far and goes outside the bounds of what God has permitted the civil magistrate to do and to be? He is the servant unto thee for good. But what happens if the civil magistrate becomes one who rules not for good but for evil? And this is where the Christian believer finds the difficulty of implementing absolutely Romans chapter 13, verses 1-7. You see, there's a principle in the Bible. And the principle is this: we always obey God rather than men. And when Paul here says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, he does not mean, he cannot mean, in every single instant, always, everywhere, without demur or question, you must be subject to the civil magistrate. He can't mean that. Because obviously to mean that would be to violate other teachings that we find in the Bible. In Acts chapter 4 and in Acts chapter 9, we find the early apostles taking a stand. We must obey God rather than men. They were being brought before the rulers of the day, the high priestly party, for preaching and teaching Christ. And you remember they were basically told to shut up and keep quiet. And they said, well, we will not keep quiet. We will keep on preaching against the prohibition. And you must make up your own mind, but we know what our mind is going to be. It is going to be, we obey God before we obey men. So is there in any place, at any time, a place for Christians to disobey and not to submit to the civil magistrate? Of course there is. And this is where the difficulties lie. And this is where the reformers and the Puritans had difficulty. Where do you draw the line? This is where the difficulty lies. And basically the Puritans and the Scottish reformers and Covenanters believed that when the civil magistrate went too far and began to encroach upon the realm that belongs to King Jesus, at that point they would obey Jesus rather than the civil magistrate. Whether he be James the Sixth, whether he be Charles the First, or whoever he be, they would disobey him, or Charles the Second, which led to the great killing times in Scotland from the 1660s into the early 1680s in Scotland, as you well know. because they were acting on a basic principle that we find in the Scripture. And we find this basic principle that we obey God rather than men, not only in terms of theory, but we find it also in terms of practice. Let me give some examples of what I mean. Well, the apostles, of course. They went out, you remember, from the presence of the high priest. They had been buffeted, they had been scourged and told to keep quiet. And they went out and they went everywhere preaching. They filled the whole of Jerusalem with their doctrine. They did not keep quiet because they knew that God had told them to go and preach. You see, the civil magistrate, in his claims and in his authority over us, may conflict with God's claims and God's authority over us. In what kind of circumstances? Supposing the civil magistrate forbids Christian believers to do things that God commands. Supposing the civil magistrate commands Christians to do things that God forbids. Why were the early Christians persecuted by the Roman authorities? Because they refused to give divine honors to King Caesar, to put some incense on the altar and say, Caesar is Lord. They knew that Caesar was not Lord. That was an act not only of homage and loyalty to the Roman Empire. It was an act of deification of the emperor. And the Christian believers would not say that anyone was God but Christ. And for that they were willing to die. The Romans couldn't understand it. What's wrong with a little bit of incense on a burning flame and just say Caesar is Lord? That's all you have to do. Even if you don't mean it, probably half the citizens in the Roman Empire didn't accept that Caesar was Lord. They probably all had their own gods, their local religions. But the Christians and the Jews, incidentally, also would not do it. Because this was an act of idolatry. It was blasphemy. And they were willing to pay the ultimate penalty because they would not do something that Caesar commanded them to do. And if you know the history of the Christian church, you will know there have been times and times again, even right up into modern times, when Christian believers simply have not fitted in because they are being required to do things that is against their conscience towards God. And they will serve God rather than men. And sometimes the civil magistrate may well forbid what God commands. There's a command in the Scriptures. Forsake not the assembling of yourselves together. You and I have freedom of assembly. We can stand up in this liberal democracy of ours, which some people hold with contempt. I'm tired of Christian people saying what a terrible world we're living in. We're living in a very tolerant world. It puts up with us, you know. It allows us to gather here. We sit here rent-free in the center of Sydney. We have a building. It doesn't cost us all that much. Things can change, you know. And if it happens to be another religious philosophy that occupies the minds of Australian politics, it may well be that this church will have to close and become another kind of place of worship, a mosque or something. We live in a very privileged society. But it may not always be. But supposing it were that we were forbidden as Christians to gather together, and the civil magistrate was to say, no more Christian gatherings in public. That's common enough. That happens in parts of the world today. A Christian gathering like this would not be allowed in certain countries, especially in Islamic countries in the Middle East. It's not allowed. Unless you get a special permit. You may be an important worker in the oil industry. You may be an important person in the military services, a pilot of a plane or a driver of a tank or something. You can get a special. There's always special dispensations for special people. But you and I are just ordinary people. And it's highly unlikely that we would get any special permission. So what do we do? Do we therefore stop assembling together because the civil magistrate says no gatherings of Christians? No. And it may be at the cost of our life and in danger of our life and limb that we would gather together because we obey God rather than men. That's what all this is about, you see. This is the difficulty of all of this. And it's all very well for Christian people to be saying, well, we're going to hold for the Queen and others are going to be holding for this. And some say as, and there are theonomists and they say we should have theocracies in the world. Where did they get that idea from? Certainly not from the Bible, properly understood, that is. Let me give some examples from the Bible. Take the time of the Babylonian exile. Now, the prophet Jeremiah had preached before the Babylonian exile. Do you remember what he had told the people of Judah? He said, you're going to be carried away into Babylon for 70 years. Now he says, you have to settle down in Babylon. You have to plant yourself some crops. He says, you're to build houses. You're to pray for the king of Babylon, he said. You're to live in Babylon as citizens in a strange land, a foreign empire. But you mustn't become Babylonians. You must be always people of Jehovah, because you're going to come back again and rebuild the fallen ruins of the temple. So how did the people of God in Babylon respond? Well, we know how some of them responded. Take the three young men in Daniel chapter 3. There was a decree went out from Nebuchadnezzar that at the sound of certain musical instruments, at a certain festivity, there was a great big golden image, 90 feet high, 9 feet wide, a monstrous looking thing, covered with pure gold, we're told. And whenever you hear, and there's all the different musical instruments, things sound like bagpipes and drums and who knows all what the music plays, everybody's going to bow down and worship this golden image. Now, you can't get a clearer directive from the civil magistrate than that. Jeremiah had said, submit to the king of Babylon. But there were three young men when that music began, and they remained standing. One of the commentators makes the point rather well. They weren't sitting. If, in fact, Nebuchadnezzar had said, let everybody stand when the music plays, you could remain sitting and nobody would see you. But let everybody bow down, and three young men remain standing. Can you imagine it? The multitude on the plain there of Shinar, and three men standing up. They were obvious. They stood out like the proverbial sore thumb. And it was reported to King Nebuchadnezzar. You know the story. You read all about it in Daniel chapter 3. And you remember how the king pleaded with the... He reasoned with them. Now let's go through it again. Let's do this again. You remember the three young men? They said to him, we will not... He challenged them, you see. Is your God able to deliver you out of a fire? If you don't do what I say, you're going to go into a fire 7 times hotter. And do you think any God's going to deliver you? And they said, well, be it known unto you, O king, our God is able to deliver us, but even if he does or even if he doesn't, be it known unto you, we will not bow down to your gods or worship them. And we all know the story. The fiery furnace and the flame didn't even touch them. Now that was an act of civil, religious, obvious disobedience. Were these three young men right or wrong to disobey Nebuchadnezzar? Of course they were right. You see, Nebuchadnezzar had gone too far. The civil magistrate goes too far when he commands us or forbids us or commands us to do something that God has forbidden. You will not bow down to golden idols, they had been told. And Nebuchadnezzar could light the fire as hot as he ever cared to make it. They still would not bow down to his golden idols or worship his gods. Take another example out of the book of Daniel. Take Daniel himself in the 6th chapter. During the reign of King Darius, he made a decree that nobody... He was put up to it, you see, because Daniel's enemies saw him worshipping and praying towards Jerusalem with his open window 3 times a day. And the prohibition went out from King Darius that nobody was to make any petition to any god or to anybody except to Darius for a period of 30 days. And you remember what we're told in the book of Daniel chapter 6. Daniel, what did Daniel do? He just carried on as normal. He prayed 3 times a day. His opponents, they spied on him, they saw, and they reported to the king. And you remember how Darius was sorry. The lion's den was prepared. And remember how Darius himself came when Daniel was put in the lion's den. May your God deliver you. The morning he came hastily in the morning to see Daniel in the lion's den. And Daniel was there alive. The lions hadn't touched him. Daniel, are you alive? It's all right, King Darius. My God has sent his angel to shut the mouths of the lions. That was an act, you see, of civil disobedience. Daniel continued to do something that was that was prohibited. Was Daniel right or wrong? Daniel was right, because the civil magistrate had gone too far. Take our Lord Jesus Christ. There are two occasions in the narratives of Christ in the Gospels where he seems on the face of it to be disrespectful of civil authority. Remember the time that he made no reply to Herod? That was impolite. It was also a kind of silent disobedience, because Herod was going too far. He was asking Jesus to do something that was unlawful. A little miracle just for me. And Jesus gave him no sign and gave him no sermon. He said nothing to him. The other occasion is before Pontius Pilate, when Jesus for a time refused to speak to Pilate. Pilate said, "Have you no idea who I am? Don't you speak to me? I'm the Roman governor here, you know. I'm your judge. I can release you. I can." And then Jesus told him. Was Jesus right or wrong? Of course he was right. Herod was going too far. Pilate was going too far in crucifying an innocent man. You see, there comes a time when Christians must stand up and be counted. Let every soul be subject to the higher powers. As long as the higher powers behave themselves, as long as the higher powers, whether it's monarchist, republic, or Islamic government, or Nero's government, let whatever government be that be, if they allow Christians to worship their God and live in peace, then we will obey them. If they ask us to disobey God, we will disobey them. And that's the issue. And that is where Christians have differed. And that's where religious wars have come from. That's where Christian sectarianism has come from. A lot of the divisions in the churches have come from attitudes that have to do with civil magistrates and the issue of church and state. And a great deal of trouble could have been avoided. And the Christian church could have had a far greater credibility in the world than it does have, if only we had learned that the Christian life is full of duties to God and to men, and that includes the civil government of the day. We may not like it. I'm not saying that I particularly like the present government, but it's tolerable. It could be a lot worse, it could be a lot better. But we obey it, because for us today, that is God's ordinance in governing the land. That's God's purpose for us. And our duty to God in Romans 13 is laid out to do not with a government that is ideal, but the government that actually is today. That's what this is all about, you see. But we need to look at this more fully. That's just general outlines. We'll come to this more fully in a week or two. May God bless his word.